on. Now I think I see all kinds of things in recording, indicating that we're recording, which is good. So we'll start again with, this is the 13th of November, Wednesday, 2013. I'm at the office of Professor Alex Harrison at the University of Toronto, and my name is Mike Grayson, and we're going to do an oral history interview of Professor Harrison and his career. So now that we have the formality out of the way, with regard to that, I'll go ahead and ask Professor Harrison to tell us something about his parents and his early childhood, his upbringing, and those kinds of things.
Okay, I'm an April Fool. I was born April 1st, 1931, in Peterborough, Ontario. Peterborough is a city about 100 kilometers northeast of Toronto. My parents were farmers, so I'm a farm boy. We lived for the first 6 years of my life on a farm a bit north of Peterborough, at which time we moved to southwestern Ontario and ended up on a farm almost halfway between the cities of London and Sarnia. For American people, Sarnia will be known as being across the river from Port Huron, Michigan. So that was the area. It wasn't too far from Detroit either. So I, from age of six on, I grew up on a farm. The local town was called Watford. My primary school was a one-room rural schoolhouse, in which my aunt actually happened to be the teacher. So there was grade 1 to 8 all in one room. That went fairly smoothly. I got through. Well, my birthday was essentially at Easter time, and I was allowed to start school right after that. There weren't as many formalities, so my grade 1 was from Easter till the end of June. And I came back in the fall, I was in grade 2.
So you kind of took a rapid advancement in your...
I finished primary school, grade 8, at the age of 12. And went to high school in the local town Watford. I think the total population of Watford is about 1,000, and there was 100 to 150 students in the school.
Is that Watford or Waterford?
Watford, W-A-T-F-O-R-D.
Okay. I just a minute go and talk a little bit about the farm upbringing. Were you during your childhood? Were you involved in the farming activities or?
Oh yes. Yes, this was once I got into high school in 1943. Yes, they had a scheme by the time I was in grade 12 or 11 during the war, of course, that you could be excused from school early to help the war effort by going home and working on the farm. So I did that a couple of summers after. Getting out, say, first of May or so, getting out of school. My grades were considered good enough.
Yeah. And so what kind of farming was this?
It was mixed.
Okay.
Dairy cattle, some beef cattle, sheep, pigs.
Okay. So it wasn't, you didn't grow crops as much as you did?
Not to sell, no. It was a 100-acre farm, so okay. You couldn't do a lot.
So that you did that during high school for a couple of years, and then
I finished high school in 1948.
So somewhere along the line, this development of your career. By the way, let's get the names of your parents down. I think that's important. Your father's name was.
He was Leslie Harrison.
Leslie.
Yes, and my mother's name was Grace.
Okay.
So my mother died in early 1945.
Oh my. Okay.
And so my father and I were bachelors on the farm from then on.
Okay. So you're the only child?
I had a brother. He was 6 years older than me, and he was in the Navy in the latter part of the Second World War.
Okay.
And was not at the farm.
I see.
He was allergic to every animal and plant that existed on the farm. So as soon as he was 16 and could legitimately quit school, he moved to London and got a job.
Oh,
he was much better off in the urban atmosphere than the rural atmosphere.
And his name was?
His name was Don, Donald.
And is he still alive?
Or? No, he died about 17 years ago.
Oh, wow, okay.
So, he was 6 years older than me.
Yeah, yeah. So and your mother's maiden name was?
Edwards.
Edwards, Grace Edwards, okay. Now, you were grew up on a farm, but was there an emphasis on education in the family, or?
Yes, my mother had been a teacher before she married.
Okay.
In rural one-room schoolhouses.
Uh-huh.
So she certainly encouraged. And it was a largely Scottish community.
Okay.
And they played a great emphasis on education.
Okay. So that's important to understand that the impact of early influences on your career and decision to go into highly educated.
Well, I didn't. At that time, farming was very physical, demanding, and I didn't think I had the physique to really carry on as a farmer. Excuse me for the cough.
We both have some kind of problem this morning.
So I didn't know quite what I was going to do when I finished high school.
Okay. Was there any teacher in high school that gave you, that inspired you anyway?
Well, it was clear that if I was going to go on for any further education, it was science or mathematics. Mm-hmm. It certainly wasn't the arts. And one of the, so I sort of got into chemistry by default. One of my, local man, a young chap, had just done well at Ontario Agricultural College, studying soil chemistry.
Uh-huh.
And this got a lot of publicity. So I thought, well, maybe I'll go to Ontario Agricultural College and study soil chemistry.
Uh-huh.
So I applied there. And they wrote back and said, well, you have to be 18 before you can go, and I was only 17.
Uh-huh.
So I thought, well, maybe I'll wait a year. So I went to Sarnia, which was the Chemical Valley of...
How do you spell that?
S-A-R-N-I-A.
Okay, Sarnia.
It was the Chemical Valley of Ontario.
Uh-huh.
And I applied for a job in all the companies there, Dow Chemical, various other ones,
uh-huh.
and got nothing.
So you were interested in trying to start your career, and they were interested in not.
So this was getting us on into the summer of 1948, and I should note that at that time there was a grade 13. High school now ends at grade 12,
right.
But then it didn't. It was grade 13. The final exams in grade 13 were province-wide. They were set by the Ontario Ministry of Education. So everybody wrote the same final exam in each subject.
Uh-huh.
The University of Western Ontario, which is in London, had the habit of giving a scholarship to the top student at each high school in its catchment area.
Uh-huh.
And so I happened to be first in Watford High School in those exams, so I got a scholarship from Western, 2 years tuition.
No, this London you're speaking of is London...
London, Ontario.
Ontario, okay.
Yes.
That's going to make sense.
Which is 2 or 3 hours west of here.
Okay. And they say the catch...
in the high schools in their sort of area,
uh-huh.
they offered a scholarship of 2 years free tuition
uh-huh.
to the top student at each grade 13.
And that area is what you refer to as a catch...
What I call a catchment area, the high schools that they would get their students from.
I see. Okay.
So I decided to go to Western University.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, gee, if I'm going to a real university, I'll study mathematics and become an accountant or an actuary.
Uh-huh.
I like playing with numbers.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
The first year was completely common for science and mathematics at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my first introduction to calculus.
Oh, boy.
And somehow or other, I didn't get it. So I decided that after the first year, if I went on in mathematics, I was going to see more calculus. So I became a chemist.
So you had enough exposure to chemistry to feel that this was something that you that could
was,
manage?
That, I thought that was a very good choice, yes. Okay. And I've never regretted it.
Well, you know, it's too bad you didn't go into mathematics then. Maybe you would have been a great mathematician.
I'll leave that to my grandson.
Okay. Is he just studying mathematics? Or
pardon?
Is he studying mathematics?
He has a bachelor's degree in mathematics. Oh, okay. And is a graduate student at University of California, Berkeley.
Oh, excellent.
So I graduated in 1952 from... Uh-huh. Honors Chemistry from University of Western Ontario.
Okay, now, but you refer to this as maybe not a real university?
Oh, it was a real university, yes. Okay. It's a major university. Okay. It was one of the big four in, around at that time.
Uh-huh.
And I stayed on there for a master's degree, where I worked on free radical addition of mercaptans to olefins.
Uh-huh.
Photochemical initiated, and got my master's degree in 1953.
Okay.
And then went on to McMaster University, which is MCMASTER.
Right, and that's located
in Hamilton.
In Hamilton. Okay.
Which is. That's sort of at the end of Lake Ontario, the west end of Lake Ontario.
Okay.
So it's fairly close from here. And I worked, started my PhD studies there,
mm-hmm.
and worked with a man by the name of Professor Harry Thode, T-H-O-D-E.
Mm-hmm. Now, were there any inspirational chemistry teachers in this route from undergraduate through master's degree?
Oh, I certainly, at Western, the man I did my master's degree with, Professor Siverts,
yes.
S-I-V-E-R-T-Z,
uh-huh.
was quite a significant influence on my life.
Uh-huh. And that was because?
He encouraged me in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so I enjoyed working with him. Professor Thode at McMaster was gave me a lot of free rein,
mm-hmm.
Encouraged me to do things on my own, so it worked out very well.
Mm-hmm. So the Siverts was more of a mentor as a, when you were a graduate student?
Yes. Okay. And well, I did a fourth-year research project with him as well, so it was both fourth-year and first year of graduate school.
Do you recall the circumstances of that period with regard to, you know, cost of college? How did you pay for your... Well, you did. You say you got was it 2 year?
2 years free tuition.
Free tuition, and then you had to pick up your.
My father essentially picked up the. Well, there was one thing in 1948,
mm-hmm.
about the time I got the offer of the free tuition at the University of Western Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
The local Rotary Club operated a calf club.
Calf.
And so what they did was they brought in a bunch of calves from. The West in the fall,
uh-huh.
and the farmer's sons and daughters picked out one and fed it and trained it and showed it then in the following August.
Okay.
And I think that was the only time I ever went in the calf club was that year.
Uh-huh.
My father picked out the calf.
Uh-huh.
It ended up being the champion.
Oh, wow.
Calf when it was shown in August of 48.
Uh-huh.
And sold for $900.
Okay.
That was a lot of money in those days.
Oh, yeah.
So that helped get me through university. But my father helped, of course.
Sure.
So
yeah.
I'll help you as long as you come home and work on the farm in the summertime.
Uh-huh. So you were still at this farm influence well after you started going to college.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, but do you recall then what the expenses were for tuition those days or any?
Oh, it was probably less than $500.
For a semester?
For a year.
For the year. Well, okay. And you also had living expenses, I assume.
Yes.
Yeah. So you had to take care of that.
So I was determined once I got my bachelor's degree that I wouldn't be dependent on my father again.
Okay.
So I managed to get scholarships, and
okay.
I did have to borrow the money from the university's loan office to pay my tuition for the master's degree.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, a year after I graduated, they said I had to pay it back.
Ah.
I told them I was still a graduate student at McMaster, but that didn't cut any ice.
Yeah.
So I went to my supervisor, Professor Thode, explained my problem. He at that time was involved with a thyroid clinic,
uh-huh.
which was on the campus. And the thyroid clinic, they gave people a trace level of radioactive iodine.
Okay.
And then after 24 hours, found out how much was protein bound,
uh-huh.
which is a measure of thyroid activity. That's where the iodination of tyrosine primarily occurs. My job was to handle the radioactive iodine and do the measurements of percent incorporation into protein. If the thyroid was too active, then they got a larger dose of radioactive iodine to kill off some of the thyroid.
Ah, okay.
So I worked several years.
This was a paying job.
This was a paying job, and the University of Western Ontario agreed I could pay so much per month to repay my debt.
So when the iodine is, it says it causes the iodination of percent.
Tyrosine. Primarily, I think it's tyrosine.
Ah, okay.
And this occurs in the thyroid.
So this actually was both kind of...
It was interesting.
It was an experimental program or a treatment program?
It was both.
Both.
I think they were still feeling their way a bit, but they certainly weren't treating people.
So basically checking out the activity of the iodination process represented information about the activity of the thyroid,
of the thyroid gland, yes.
And whether it was overactive and so on. So they
yes, I forget the numbers, but if you had more than a certain percentage incorporation of the iodine into protein, then your thyroid was overactive. If you didn't have very much iodine detachment, then you had another problem. You had a thyroid that wasn't active enough, and then that that had to be treated in a different way.
Oh, I see. That's okay. So you kind of got a little bit of exposure to the biological side of the world at an early period, even though you didn't know that you'd end up in a
biological
business.
Right.
It would be a career.
Exactly. So I got my PhD in 56.
That was a work on sulfur?
I was working on... Professor Thode had two main lines of research. One was nuclear phenomena.
Okay.
I'd hoped to get into that, but he was very persuasive and got me into sulfur isotope geochemistry.
Oh, okay. Geochemistry.
What I was supposed to do was set up the sulfur cycle in the lab.
Sulfur cycle?
There's a bacteria which will reduce sulfate to sulfide.
Ah, okay.
There are other bacteria which will oxidize the sulfide to sulfate. And the idea was to make up a mix of these two, both anaerobic, and see how much fractionation there was of the sulfur isotopes between sulfate and sulfide.
Okay.
If you do the calculations, it should be about 6 or 7% enrichment of the sulfate and the heavy isotope sulfur-34.
Oh, okay.
So the first thing I was told, people had looked at the bacteria that reduced sulfate to hydrogen sulfide.
Okay.
And reported that occurred with about a 1.1% fractionation, sulfur-32 reacting more rapidly.
Okay.
So Professor Thode said, well, set up the thing and do this again just to get experience.
Yeah.
I got no isotope effect.
Uh-huh.
So he said, you've done something wrong.
Of course.
Do it again. So I took very great pains and did it for quite a long time. And it turned out that when the bacteria were first young and growing, there was no isotope fractionation. But as they got old, there was isotope fractionation, out to about 2%.
Hmm.
So my project now became trying to understand this.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say. Why would that
happen? It turned out when the bacteria are very, very active, the rate-determining step in the reduction of the sulfate is the transport across the cell wall.
Okay.
And that is isn't involving breaking bonds or anything, so there's no isotope effect. When they get slow and old and slow, like us, then the actual reduction of sulfate in the cell becomes the rate determining, and that occurs with an isotope effect.
Okay, so one of them is like a transfer or a diffusion situation.
Yes, one is the, it's an active transport across the cell wall.
Okay.
But
and then later on it's actually
It's actually breaking bonds, and that occurs with an isotope effect.
Interesting. So then this I think probably represented a very nice contribution to the understanding of that process in the literature.
I must say it's one of my most cited papers.
Really?
Yes.
Very good.
The paper we published on that, which was in the Transactions of the Faraday Society, so it wasn't actually a biological journal.
No. But so it is surprising. I mean, to me it is a little bit surprising that the change in a heavier isotope would be. Is that a common biological response to the heavier isotope? Is more, there's a difference in the reactivity of the...
If you look at systems in nature where you have both sulfide and sulfate, or... Mm-hmm. You find that the sulfate is enriched in sulfur 34 compared to the sulfide.
Hmm.
That's about 6 or 7%.
I see. And any other? Do you?
And of course, that involved me with mass spectrometry to analyze the sulfur isotope ratios.
So you were using a mass spectrometer in these experiments that you did with those.
Yes.
Okay. So what kind of an instrument was that?
It was a homemade magnetic deflection, 90-degree electron impact source.
Sure. So does that?
So the sulfur compounds were all converted to sulfur dioxide.
Uh-huh.
And then the isotope ratio measured.
So you're like the range of what is that? The 64 and 66 sulfur dioxide.
Yeah, it was that. Yeah. Yes.
Probably
yes.
A low mass.
Yeah.
Was this 90-degree sector homemade instrument based on something that was in the literature, or do you know, or how did that, who put that together? You didn't do that, did you?
No, that was, I'd been there for some time.
Uh-huh.
McMaster was a center for mass spectrometry.
Okay.
When I finished at McMaster, I went on to the National Research Council in Ottawa.
Uh-huh.
And worked with one Fred Lossing.
Okay.
Lossing.
Uh-huh.
And he had several instruments, which again were homemade, and I think were largely made at McMaster.
I see.
So they were, again, 90-degree magnetic sector instruments.
So this is pretty much a standard type of instrument that was...
It was very common in Ontario at that time.
Yeah. Okay. And does this fellow work pretty well? Is it a pretty well-performing instrument for your sulfur studies?
Yes, that was...
Didn't
quite
have
well.
Any idiosyncrasies or cause you any headaches?
Oh, yes, it did, yes. Mass spectrometry was not terribly reliable in those days.
Uh-huh.
And so we had several periods when it wasn't really functioning terribly well.
When you recorded spectra, was this on a strip chart recorder, or did you do this?
You didn't actually record spectra.
Ah, okay.
The instrument had dual collector slits.
So it was an isotope ratio. Kind of
and so you measured the ratio of that.
Uh-huh.
And it had a switch, so you could switch back and forth between your sample and the standard.
Uh-huh.
And see how far that position of equilibrium of the ratio changed.
Uh-huh.
And that's how you got your isotope ratio.
So this was pretty much dedicated to this type of measurement?
Yes.
Ah, okay. wouldn't be the kind of instrument that you would walk in and say, let's take a look at this.
We never looked at, I remember being, somebody did look at a mass spectrum in the instrument at some stage or another instrument and couldn't understand what this big peak was at mass to charge ratio 78.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Of course, it was benzene.
Yeah, right.
But we'd never seen a mass spectrum before.
Yeah. So only looking at those two ions and the ratio. So
yes.
If it works for that, then... Now, did you have to like tune it up for that process, or was it pretty much all set up? Or, I mean, you had to probably do it.
It had its difficult days.
In terms of making sure that you were
everything was working right. Yes.
Two ions, two isotopes that you wanted to look at.
Of course, it was metal flight tube through the magnet,
yeah.
But the ends were glass. And when you had to change the filament, you had to break open the glass envelope, put a new filament in, then glass blow the glass envelope back on.
Yeah.
So you learned how to become a glass blower.
So you were actually doing this glass blowing work yourself?
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay. But then, of course, after that, you had to pump it out forever to get rid of the moisture.
Yes, oh, yes, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So this was pretty much traditional. So do you have a recollection of what the radius of this instrument would be?
Like six inch.
6 inch, okay. It's probably about standard.
Mm-hmm.
So your first exposure to mass spec was in a kind of a really just a limited isotope ratio type.
Yes. Yes.
So that was probably, I don't know how far back isotope ratio mass spec goes. I guess it goes back into the 30s.
I would think so. Yes.
Yeah.
I think most of the work on isotope geochemistry probably started more in the 40s.
Uh huh. Okay. So this really, although you were looking at bacteria, it was for a geochemistry purpose.
The
how did that connect?
Well, I finished my PhD in 56.
Okay.
And it wasn't clear I was going to make the fall convocation in 1956. So Professor Thode said, well, you could either carry on as a graduate student, or if you do make convocation, I'll hire you as a postdoc.
Okay.
So I made the convocation.
And what was the limitations of that may or may not have been able to?
Well, I didn't get enough results and didn't get it written up. The thesis.
It's a matter of completion.
The usual problems.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the time as a postdoc with Thode, I actually looked at fractionation of natural samples from various.
Okay.
One paper was from samples from Venezuela. The other one was from the Uinta Basin in Utah, and looking at the sulfur isotopes in various forms of sulfur in the petroleum deposits.
So that
was. I actually had two papers in Geochemica and Cosmochemica Acta, which described that work.
And so that gave you that kind of. Use the information that you determined in your PhD research.
Yes, it was more the applications of this.
Oh, okay.
In 1957, I thought, oh, well, mass spectrometry is not bad, but I don't want to stay in isotope geochemistry.
Okay.
And I had a background from my master's degree with free radicals.
Now, tell me about the free radical stuff.
Well,
and your master's background.
It was the photochemical addition of mercaptans to olefins, which is a free radical chain reaction.
Okay.
And actually, at that time, mercaptans were sometimes used as to to affect the chain length. You could stop a chain of polymer growing by abstracting up hydrogen from the say butyl mercaptan.
Okay.
So I had some background in in free radical chemistry.
Okay.
Background in mass spectrometry. And Fred Lossing at the National Research Council in Ottawa. That's Lossing.
Okay, yeah, I've got Fred's name. That's good.
Was doing free radical biomass spectrometry.
Uh-huh.
So I thought that sounds like a good idea. So I went to, I got a position as a postdoc with him. Starting in the fall of 1957.
Okay.
And we had measured ionization potentials of free radicals, measured photochemical decompositions of compounds, what free radicals were formed.
So this was all really kind of very fundamental.
Yes.
Research in. And I guess this would be appropriate for a National Research Council activity.
Yes.
So, now he, was he, did the National Research Council have a, were they funding this, or were they the organization that he was inside of doing this work?
He was an employee of the National Research
Okay.
Council.
Okay.
They had a division of chemistry.
Uh-huh.
which he was involved in. There was an analytical aspect to the work as well. One of the instruments had a full-time technician, and we're analyzing gas samples from the large photochemistry group that was in the Division of Chemistry.
Okay.
And then there were two instruments devoted to research.
Okay, so you actually were doing some, like say, analytical work with photochemistry.
Well, the lab was. I didn't get involved in it except once or twice, maybe.
But they did have some analytical applications.
Oh yes.
Okay. These were all with homemade instruments that Lossing was.
Yes.
Okay, so he was.
He had spent some time when he was first appointed to National Research Council. He'd been sent down to McMaster to learn mass spectrometry and get some instruments built.
Okay, who were the big guns at McMaster that were leading the mass spec charge there?
Professor Thode was the main man.
He was basically had a mass spec interest or background?
Yes.
Okay, so he was not really an analytical chemist, but he had a lot of interest in mass spectrometry.
Yes,
he saw that as a powerful tool for what needed to be done. Mm-hmm. So,
and they were doing fission. Some people in the department were doing fission yields. Nuclear chemistry was big just after the Second World War.
Sure. And so, as you mentioned before, he had these two different areas of research, and you wanted to get into one, but he pushed you into one. So the other research was this nuclear chemistry research.
Well, actually, it turned out he mostly had physics students doing that work.
Ah, okay. And so that was...
which I hadn't realized before I signed up.
Okay. Well, that would make sense for the physics students, but still, I mean, it's got a chemical kind of a flavor to it.
Yes.
I would assume that mass spec would have been more analytical in nature on the nuclear chemistry side.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, was a big driving force in mass spectrometry in Canada, the development of mass spec in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I wasn't really aware of that. Did you know anything about his background or how he got into that?
He was originally from Western Canada.
Okay.
He studied in the United States. I think he studied with Harold Urey.
Oh, okay.
And then was hired back into Canada at McMaster.
Okay. Well, that would make sense since Urey was using mass spec in the 30s.
I'm pretty sure that Thode worked with Urey.
Okay. I could check on that. That would be interesting to find out.
He was heavily involved in administration at the university, the pastor, and in the 60s served some time as president.
I see. McMaster then is Rutherford was where Rutherford came over to Canada.
McGill, I think.
McGill, okay. Yeah, okay. All right. I didn't mean to get too far distracted there, but it was interesting. Obviously, I'm interested in mass spectrometry and the history, and I know quite a bit about what happened in the early part of the United States, but I wasn't aware of the importance of this fellow Thode and his use of the mass spectrometry in Canada and the fact that he was promoting the development and building of it.
Yes. Lossing at the National Research Council usually had two postdoctoral students working with him on a two-year basis, one appointed, so they sort of stepped. The first one, when I first went there, his other postdoc was Paul Kabarly.
Oh, I know Paul.
Everybody knows Paul.
Yeah.
So I worked for a year with Paul.
Oh, that's great. And so what kind of work were you doing then? This was...
free radical ionization energies, it was the first attempts to get bond energies. If you say measured the appearance energy of the methyl cations from methane, and then measured the ionization energy of the methyl radical, you could use a thermochemical cycle to get a bond energy.
Okay.
So that was a lot of the activity in terms of measuring ionization energies was to try to get bond energies. And then he used another area was mercury photosensitized decomposition of organic molecules and trying to detect the first products, the free radicals that were formed.
Mercury sensitized decomposition. What's going on there?
There's a long-lived state of mercury, excited states, which when you put photons in, you excite the mercury, which then transfers the energy to the organic molecule. And so we published several papers of that area as well.
So this would be another way of getting into energetics?
Understanding the primary processes and when you photolyze this organic molecule.
So the photochemistry part of the was looking at appearance potentials and ionization?
That was the electron impact for ionization energies and appearance potentials.
And so they were doing photoionization as well in this in the photo?
Well, it was photo excitation of the mercury.
Ah, okay.
It wasn't ionization directly. Then there was a reaction chamber then that fed into an electron impact source to actually ionize the free radicals.
Okay. So you were just kind of a little bit more subtle than an ionization?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So you were doing, this was a job or a postdoctoral appointment at this point?
Pardon?
This was a job or a postdoc?
It was a postdoc.
A postdoc.
Yes.
Okay. So you basically, this was like a two-year...
I had a two-year postdoc at the National Research Council, okay. Yes, right. with Fred Lawson.
Yeah, all right. And so you were really exposed to mass spec, even some more there?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. And kind of felt this might be a home, or did you have any ideas about maybe going to some other areas of chemistry? Or?
No, I was looking for a job in which involved mass spectrometry.
That was a
decision I made to go to Lawson. Was I thought that would be the field that I would fit best in.
Okay.
I thought of doing a postdoc in radiation chemistry, but mm-hmm. It looked awfully complicated.
I think it is. So that was you pretty much committed when you got your graduated with your PhD. You'd pursue mass spec for the time being anyway.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So was there any other interesting things that you did during your two-year postdoc with Lossing at the National Research Council?
We had a lot of fun. I remember meeting Paul Cabarly for the first time.
Uh-huh.
Paul said, well, nice to meet you. And then within 30 seconds he said, do you ski? I said, no. Paul said, you will learn. we did. But this time I was married.
That's pretty interesting. Yeah, Paul is quite a character.
Yes, so we did a lot of skiing the first winter when he was still there.
Okay, was he a good teacher in skiing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So let's see, is this good ski country here at McMaster, is it, or no?
This was in Ottawa.
Ottawa.
And okay. There was a good skiing just about an hour's drive north of Ottawa in the Quebec province.
Okay. So you'd go up there and learn?
We'd go up there and spend Saturdays skiing if the weather wasn't too cold. So by 1958-59, I was looking for hopefully a permanent position. I heard in spring of 58 that one D.J. Leroy at the University of Toronto, that's capital L, lowercase e, capital R, O Y.
First name was what?
Well, he was Donald Leroy, but he was always called DJ.
DJ, okay.
He was a senior, one of the senior physical chemists in the department.
Mm-hmm.
And he again did gas phase photochemistry.
Okay.
By the middle of the 50s, he was having problems analyzing his, getting analysis of his samples.
Mm-hmm.
So he got money to buy a mass spectrometer.
Okay.
And somehow or other, there was a long delay between him getting the money and the mass spectrometer being delivered.
Mm-hmm.
And gas liquid chromatography developed to the extent during that period that it solved his analytical problems.
Okay.
I heard about this, and so Leroy was having a mass spec, but he didn't have any use for it. So I was in Toronto in the spring of 58 for a conference, and I made a point of visiting the department and introducing myself to Leroy. And to make a long story short, I was hired here in 59.
Okay.
I came on duty, I think, the 1st of August. The mass spectrometer finally arrived about October, November in 59.
Uh-huh.
And it was mine. It was the Metropolitan Vickers.
Okay.
MS-2.
Wow. and this instrument, was there any reason that it gave for the delay between...
I never did get that clearly explained to me.
Uh-huh. And Leroy, did he have any problems with his leadership because he had ordered an instrument they now didn't need? Or?
I never heard of any problem.
Uh-huh.
The department was expanding at that time, so they...
So did you actually talk to Leroy personally about this?
I visited him in the spring of 58 and said I was available. So in the late fall of 58, I was invited to visit the department, give a talk and meet people.
Mm-hmm.
And sometime in the winter of 59, I was offered a position as a lecturer.
Mm, okay. So a lecturer position is kind of like the starting point for...
At that time, the Department of Chemistry, and I'm not sure what other parts of the university, made their initial... tenure stream appointments at the rank of lecturer.
Okay.
I was told that if my performance was satisfactory, I'd be promoted to assistant professor after 1 year.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't actually say it, but I presume if my performance wasn't satisfactory, I was out of my year.
Yeah, right.
so I was promoted to assistant professor in 1960. And at that stage, because the competition for faculty was getting... there was quite an expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Initial appointments began to be made at the assistant professor level.
Okay. So in this lecturer position that you had for a year, did you actually do what that says, or did you...
Oh, yes.
So you were really teaching?
Right? I was teaching, yes. That was yes. Yes.
You didn't have any research activities going on at that time?
Well, the Metropolitan Vickers MS-2 arrived about October, November.
Uh-huh.
I'd been assigned a fourth-year student to... the fourth year student did a research project.
Okay.
This chap,
undergraduate,
yeah. Yes, and he was assigned to work with me. Mm-hmm. A man by the name of Tate, T-A-I-T. And so he was there to get the machine running, and then did research. And he actually stayed on then after he graduated and did a master's degree with me.
Okay.
So he was my first graduate student.
And his first name was?
James.
James Tate. So tell me about this, the performance characteristics of this MS-2 instrument.
It was, again, a magnetic sector instrument.
Mm-hmm.
No differential pumping. I mean, anything that went in the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think it was 6-inch radius of curvature.
And was it a... 60-degree,
90-degree?
90-degree.
Yeah. Metropolitan Vickers became AEI, of course.
You're right. You know when that happened?
Sometime in the early 60s.
Okay. Sometimes they call it MetroVic. And then it became Associated Electrical Industries.
Yes.
Part of Associated Electrical Industries.
Mm-hmm. But it had a mass range... one could just see the mercury isotopes.
Okay.
And a resolution of maybe 150.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it was sufficient for what you needed to do at the time.
We started off doing some appearance energies.
Okay.
We got into ion molecule reactions with that instrument. It was not the best instrument for it, but we did it.
How did you do ion molecule with this is a single focusing 90-degree magnetic sector instrument.
We jacked up the pressure in the source.
Okay.
and looked to see what was happening.
No differential pumping, so it increased the pressure everywhere.
We couldn't go terribly high, no.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
It did work, and we got some results out. And
so this would be working. Well, this almost would be like kind of like a chemical, what we call chemical ionization. It's kind of headed in that direction.
Well, it got there eventually when Field and Munson got a better instrument. Actually, we made another homemade instrument in the about the mid '60s,
okay,
which had differential pumping, and we could measure the source pressure directly. that was largely made again at McMaster.
Okay,
and it was the same idea: 6-inch radius of curvature, 90-degree mass spectrometer.
But the reason for this instrument was to do ion molecule reactions.
Yes.
The reason why you went ahead decided you wanted to create this new, build your own instrument, because you needed.
Yes.
You were interested in this ion molecule reaction area of research.
Yeah, I got into that. The second year I was at the National Research Council, the postdoc with Lossing was a chap by the name of Potty, Ross Potty, P-O-T-T-I-E. He'd worked with Bill Hamill at Notre Dame on ion molecule reactions.
H-A-M-I-L for Hamill?
H-A-M-I-L-L.
Okay.
And also Joe Franklin had visited the lab and gave a talk on his work on ion molecule reactions, so it looked interesting to me.
This is Franklin from...
Joe Franklin from down in Humble Oil.
Okay. I always thought that was a strange business where a small industrial petrochemical would have this, you know, people like Franklin and Field and Munson.
Yes.
Working in their lab.
They obviously got a lot of freedom to do what they wanted.
Yes. It's pretty amazing. I think... I did interview Munson. I believe that they would actually bring in, you know, high-powered chemists to talk about their science on a regular basis. The oil company. And
I think once Esso took over Humble Oil, I think that or Exxon or whatever it's called in the States.
Yeah. So we have all this emphasis from different areas that ion molecule reactions looks like something that you want to continue to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
one of the things we did with a single source instrument, you have a repeller voltage to push the ions out.
Right.
So your ion molecule reactions are of ions at different energy depending where in the path they collide and react.
Right.
Talrosa in Russia, that's T-A-L-R-O-S-E, or sometimes put a Z instead of the S, had developed a pulsing technique.
Okay.
In which he put a short pulse of electrons through to ionize. Didn't have a voltage on the repeller, and then sometime later pushed the ions out by putting a pulse on the repeller. So that's what was called the zero field system, and we took that up in 62-63.
Okay. So this gave you a better control over the energy.
We got rate constants for essentially thermal energy ions.
Okay, which is what you were really interested in.
Yes. I think the other person that took that up in North America was Gene Fitrell.
Oh, okay.
I should probably note that in 1962, I was awarded a Sloan Fellowship.
Sloan Fellowship. That means, Sloan sounds familiar, but...
Alfred P. Sloan.
Okay.
Was head honcho at General Motors for some time in the 20s and 30s.
Uh-huh.
And I guess even then, the head honchos made a lot of money.
Uh-huh.
So he set up the Sloan Foundation, the Alfred Sloan Foundation, in the mid-30s. And in 55, I think it was, they started this Alfred P. Sloan Fellowships. The idea was to find people in universities in the early stages of their career who showed promise and give them a 2-year unrestricted grant. And I was fortunate enough to be awarded one of these in 1962.
62?
Yes.
Okay.
Which also led to my getting a promotion and tenure.
Okay. So you're on the faculty, and this obviously is a feather in your cap, and it helps promote your career.
Yes, and also it gave me money to expand our activities.
How much money did Sloan give you?
Well, just to put it in perspective, my research grant 61-62 grant year was $4,000 Canadian, which sounds terribly small, but of course my salary was
$8,000.
The Sloan Foundation gave me $9,000 a year for 2 years.
Oh boy.
So.
That was a lot of money.
It was a lot of money in those days.
Yeah. Before we get into that, though, I want to back up a little bit and talk about your lectureship here. We kind of got off into your research career, but when you were teaching, what, basic organic chemistry or chemistry to freshmen?
I did a lot of teaching of chemistry to first-year students.
First-year, okay.
One of my first lecturing assignments was what I called Chemistry for Poets. There was a general arts program in which you had to take one or two science courses, and one of the most of chemistry was available.
Oh, wow.
So I taught that for a number of years.
Even after you had completed your kind of duties as a lecturer?
Oh, no.
You were
assistant professors and associate professors have their normal teaching load.
Okay.
It didn't change.
Okay. But basically, your first year, you had more of a teaching load than any other.
No.
Okay.
It was about the same every year.
Okay. In addition to Chemistry for Poets, you taught
a lot for Chemistry for First Year Life Science, Chemistry for First Year Physical Science.
Did you have any of those big 300 student sections where you had help with?
Yeah, we got some.
Yeah.
Especially later on.
Okay.
And then also I got involved in lab supervision. At that time, there was a pre-dental program.
Okay.
They took a chemistry lab.
Sure.
And I was involved in that.
So, how many people would end up in this Chemistry for Poets class?
It wasn't called that, of course.
I know.
30 or 40.
Oh, okay. So, it was relatively small compared to the large section.
There was actually a lab ran with that, too.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, they got their lab coats dirty, too.
Did any of these people ever go into chemistry as a result of the exposure, do you know? Or
not that I'm aware of.
But they did learn some chemistry.
Yes.
To help fulfill that requirement. For That's good. Okay. But then also, during the rest of your career here, teaching was part of you had a regular teaching role.
Oh, yes.
That you had to tend to.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So,
Teaching, we also had at in the early days a general science program, and there I did do some teaching in chemistry at a more advanced level then.
Okay.
And then things changed around about 1970. In the mid-70s, in the early 70s, I spent some time as associate chair of the department.
Oh, boy.
And one of the things, during the 60s, there was an argument that one didn't need to teach analytical chemistry.
Mm.
And so the analytical chemistry program had got really shut down here at U of T, and it happened at other places, too.
Yeah.
One of the things I managed to achieve as associate chair was to reintroduce analytical chemistry and convinced the department to hire an analytical chemist. So we introduced first a second-year course in analytical chemistry, and since I'd promoted it, I got the job of teaching it.
Uh-huh.
So from then on, much of my teaching was in introductory analytical chemistry. And got involved in some fourth-year courses, which were more advanced analytical chemistry. So I sort of switched from being a physical chemist to an analytical chemist.
So in this coursework, you were actually talking about all forms of I guess I would call it instrumental-based analytical chemistry, or did you teach any wet analytical?
I was the introductory course is mostly wet chemistry.
Oh, mostly wet analytical. Okay. Wow. Okay. But then later on.
We introduced a couple of years later a third year course, which was instrumental analysis.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, analytical chemistry seems to be kind of like the, what would you call it, the stray godchild or stray orphan of.
Well,
it's
come back to a considerable extent here.
Well, that's good, I think. But it seems to be something that people like to pick on and say, well, we don't really need that anymore. I don't know what the rationale is, because it's not what you've made, and, you know.
I'll just go back briefly to that Sloan Fellowship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
$9,000 was enough, more than enough to hire a postdoc.
Oh, okay, sure.
You paid him the postdoc about $5,000 a year at that stage.
Uh-huh.
So I managed to get a postdoc to come and work with me.
This was unfettered grant. You could do what you want with.
Yes. It's now $25,000 a year for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it certainly did kickstart my, give a good boost to my research activities.
Mm-hmm.
The point I think I want to make is that when it ended, fortunately the NRC grants and scholarship area division upped my grant to essentially make, to recognize that I no longer had the Sloan.
Okay.
So I was away.
Did
so
they do that without any?
Well, I applied for
you applied.
More.
Okay, you applied for more.
And then made it known.
Okay.
Yes, obviously. But they recognized that this man had got a kickstart.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Let's keep him going.
Okay.
And I think that's required even in the United States, of course, too.
Yeah.
Most of the awardees of Sloan grants are in the U.S. I've got a list of those who were received awards in 1962.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there are a number of well-known people who are now well-known chemists who got a starting kick.
I've always wondered if anyone has ever done a follow-up, like you mentioned here, on these things where grants are given to a year or a group. And does anyone ever look at that 10, 20, 30 years downstream to see how those grantees did?
I would assume that the Sloan Foundation makes some
assessments
of the utility of their method. Certainly I would say that half the chemists that got awards in 1962 are people that became well known.
Mm-hmm.
Now presumably this Sloan Fellowship helped them in that.
Mm-hmm.
John Baldersweiler, for example.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
He got a grant that year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to spell his name.
I don't either. We'll get something down here that looks like I can
And Charles Depew, or Chuck Depew,
uh-huh.
He also got an award that year.
I
forget how many Nobel Prize winners have received Sloan Fellowships, but there certainly are a number.
Yeah. I'm just curious, now this is an American foundation?
Yes.
But it's awarding grants to
United States and Canada.
United States and Canada. So, I mean, it's it's specified to include Canada. So
yes.
Like North American.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, because, I mean, and do you know if how many are they normally award these each year to someone in Canada? Or?
As far as I know, yes. Okay. Actually, in 1962, I was the only person working in Canada who got a Sloan Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were more, and certainly a number of my colleagues here have had Sloan scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
Our Nobel laureate, John Polanyi,
mm-hmm.
Got one a bit earlier than I did, I think, 57 or 58.
Mm-hmm. Now, he went into kind of philosophy eventually, didn't he, Polanyi?
No, he's still an active chemist.
Oh, okay. Maybe I'm getting confused with some other fellow.
You may be confusing with his father, Michael Polanyi.
Ah, okay.
This is John Polanyi.
Yeah, okay, very good. Thank you. Did you have travel funds that came with this, or you could use this money any which way you wanted to?
Yes, it was unrestricted.
So you could go to a meeting if you wanted to?
Yes.
Yes. And so on. Okay. So now mass spec is in the 50s and 60s, late 50s, really, it's beginning to kind of expand.
Yes.
Its territory, so to speak.
In fact, in the late 50s and 60s, of course, John Bynum in particular and others, Klaus Beeman and Fred McLafferty,
mm-hmm.
showed that you could do accurate mass measurements on smaller ions, in a way,
mm-hmm.
and work out the elemental composition.
Mm-hmm.
And the journals begin to accept this mass measurement in place of elemental analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So in the mid-60s, some of the organic chemists in the department here said we should get into this.
Mm.
So we applied in 66, I think it was, for a double-focusing mass spectrometer
mm-hmm.
to be used as for service work
mm-hmm.
and with hopefully some time for research.
Mm-hmm.
That was... we were successful and got the instrument in 1967. By now, Mitterbond Vickers was an AEI, and it was an AEI 902, okay. Venus 902.
Okay. And you got money for this instrument from?
The National Research Council.
Okay, so they once again are supporting you.
That was the source of funding through the up until 75.
Mm-hmm.
Then they set up what's called the Natural Science and Engineering Research Council.
Oh, okay.
Which is separate from NRC. But until then, they had a scholarships and grants division of the National Research Council.
So the National Research Council exists still, but it funds other things?
It doesn't. It's not a funding agency.
It's not a funding agency.
No.
It's a kind of a...
So... In 1967, I'm pretty sure it was, we got the MS-902, which actually was in the room next door here. And hired a technician to operate it.
Sure.
And that was the beginning of the service laboratory,
mm-hmm.
which has now grown enormously.
Mm-hmm.
But
now, this is service, originally it was service for the university here.
For the department.
For the department.
I guess we did a little bit of stuff from
outside,
but okay. Not a great deal.
And I'm just trying to think now, in 62 you'd have been 30 years old.
31.
31. Oh,
okay. I was born in 31.
31, oh, okay. So then this would be about a normal point in your career for advancing to... bigger and more important things with the Sloan Fellowship and then getting instruments for having large instruments. That's a fairly large instrument, the MS-902, so I don't know what they cost back then. But they put
I forget, too.
Well over 100,000, I would imagine.
Yes.
And of course...
It was what they, NRC at that time, called a major installation.
Okay, major installation.
And so they set in a visiting committee to... test you out and see if you really knew what you were doing and
okay.
so forth. Though it was a major, grant.
They didn't want somebody buying this thing just because they could get the money to buy it.
That's right. They meant that my colleagues, I was responsible for putting the grant in.
Okay.
My colleagues were called before the visiting committee to explain why and how they would make use of this facility.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So it was a full-blown effort.
So it's pretty serious. They wanted to make sure that the money was well spent.
Yes.
No. Okay. Good. And obviously it worked.
Mm.
So it was in the mid-60s that this happened.
Pardon?
Mid-60s that you got the MS-902.
So 67.
67. Now, by this time, you'd probably gone to some mass spec conferences.
Of course.
Would you recall the first one you went to?
First one I went to was in 1959.
Okay.
The ASTM Committee E14.
Right.
Met in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And Fred Lossing said many of his postdocs came from Europe, and he paid their travel expenses. So he said to me, I didn't have to pay your travel expenses, so I'll pay your way to Los Angeles.
Oh, okay.
So it was great. I mean, I met people like Fred McLafferty,
Cy
Meyerson,
sure.
all of these people I knew about.
Yeah.
Frank Field, Joe Franklin. I met Joe, I guess.
Uh-huh.
So that was my first meeting.
Yeah, that was pretty intimate group in 59, right? They were one oral session. And
the big argument in Los Angeles at that time was, we may have to go to two concurrent sessions.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Oh, that'd be terrible.
Yeah. That's you continued, I assume, to attend the ASTM aspect.
Yes.
That for a pretty regular basis.
Yes.
Okay. There's some little bit of mass spec ASTM history that I'm trying to research, and maybe you can tell me, since you went to these early meetings. And I think the last meeting they had in New Orleans was in 1962. I can find out for sure, but from what I've heard, the reason that they haven't been to New Orleans since this distant time was because one of the gentlemen who attended the conference was black, and he was not treated very kindly in New Orleans in 1962. And I don't know if...
Well, when did ASMS start?
ASMS started...
Not till the late 60s.
Yeah, it was in the late 60s, later, because the first one I went to was in 66, I think, and they were still ASTM, and they were ASTM for a couple of years. I think it was 69. ASMS.
Certainly there was meetings of the committee E14 through the 60s.
Right, and they also went alongside of ASMS meetings for a few years until the 80s.
That I don't know.
Yeah, but I was wondering if you knew anything about this race in New Orleans in 1962.
No, I wasn't there.
Okay, because that's what I hear, or I've heard, is that they haven't gone back since because of the fact that this black fellow was
well, that might well have been.
And I'm trying to find out as much as I can about that. But anyway, so now you have a technician who's doing the service work.
Yes, we did some research on it. It wasn't used full time.
Okay, and as research, what would you do? I get a double focusing, high resolving power instrument.
So we could look at metastable ions and various things like that.
Okay.
And understand fragmentations a bit better.
Okay. But you still had your own instruments research instruments that you use for other activities,
mm-hmm.
More researching type things.
And in about 1973, I managed to get money to buy a DuPont 21-490 instrument.
Okay.
For chemical ionization.
21-490. So this would have been getting towards the end of the 490. That was a single focusing?
Yes.
Okay.
Again, 90 degree.
And this was for chemical ionization that you bought?
Yes. We've also bought one... electron impact, which went into the service laboratory at about the same time.
All right.
So that got us really into chemical ionization.
That would have been the early 70s.
It's around 72, 73. I don't remember exact date.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Of course, Munson and Field had published their papers, and it looked all very interesting, and we were using it, chemical ionization on our homemade instrument, essentially, to probe structures of ions. Using different reagents to protonate the molecule to see how it fragmented.
Mm-hmm. So this was basically the chemical ionization work was the natural follow-on time molecule studies.
Yes.
You could say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that meant that you once again got back into the fundamentals continue to go into the fundamentals of...
Yes, I was more interested in the fundamentals than the analytical applications.
Of course, I mean, CI did have an impact on the analytical,
analytical
applications, because now you could, you know, analyze a whole bunch of compounds that were no longer previously with the EI.
Oh, yes, it was a very useful addition.
I would, in my sense, it was the first time that the first development, significant development in ionization had started to bring mass spec to larger and larger array of compounds.
Yes.
That's a fair assessment. Because, I mean, I think in the EI world, it was considered mostly a niche technique. I mean, I think for a long time, people considered that mass spectrometry was a little kind of a niche analytical tool.
It wasn't really a main purpose instrument.
Well, that has changed. Mostly because we could create ions out of things that we couldn't do before. I mean, that's my sense.
Well, and then, of course, electrospray and so forth really changed the world.
So what prompted your ion molecule reaction studies? You had a certain area of ion molecules that you were interested in?
I had in the back of my mind when I started doing ion molecule reactions that I might be able to use it for getting the structures of ions. It didn't work.
Okay.
Not very well. Until I got an instrument where I could put a reagent in a collision cell and stick an ion in and see what the reactions were. And that didn't happen till the 80s.
Okay.
So.
And why were you interested in the structure?
Well, that was basically what we were doing with the Walsing,
ion
structures and so forth. I got involved, I don't know how much you know about the benzyl terpillium. Which was an area that Cy Meyerson worked in completely, and we got involved with that too. What was formed was a benzyl ion or a terpillium ion that was formed, and published some papers on that.
Cy is a really interesting fellow.
Yes.
And he's, I think he just moved into retirement community a couple years ago, if I'm not mistaken.
No, he's no chicken.
Yeah.
But you said, did I attend conferences?
Yes.
Of course, I was fairly regular attendee at E14 and then ASMS. But there were also the international conferences.
Yeah.
I guess the first one I went to was in 1961. Which was held in Oxford.
Okay.
I mentioned to Leroy, who by then was head of the department, that there was this conference in Oxford. He said, would you like to go? I said, of course, but I don't have any money. Well, I'll pay for it. there was much more money at that time than there is now.
Yeah.
So we went to England. My wife is English, and so it was a chance to visit her family. I went up to Oxford to the international conference. Then 64, the international conference was in Paris. That's where I gave my first paper at an international conference.
Oh, okay.
And I've been at quite a number of other international meetings.
Now, do you recall, I know that the international conference started third or fourth international conference, the one at Oxford?
I think the one at Paris was either the third or the fourth.
Okay. So this might have been the second or third at Oxford.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And these are, did they have the triennial thing established by that time, where they've been every 3 years?
Yes, and I just learned that they switched. They're going to biennial now.
Oh, really? Very interesting.
Yeah. The international that was held in Japan in 2012,
and
it's going to be in Geneva in 2014, and it's going to be in Toronto in 2016.
Oh, there you go. Well, they haven't added this in North America, have they? The international conference? That'll be the first one.
Yep.
Oh. Interesting. Well, I don't know if anybody's been around for that. It would be interesting to be able to go to that. And so what was that conference like, the Oxford conference when you went there? It was probably, they weren't running parallel sessions, were they?
There was very little parallel session. It was, you could mostly hear it all.
in my recollection, is they also recorded the commentary at the question and answer session at the end and included that in the paper.
Yes.
Which was kind of
yes.
nice.
Yes.
So that, how did they do that? Did they have somebody that actually...
I don't know.
Because they would...
I was just trying to...
have somebody either record the stuff or maybe they had a person who did scientific shorthand or whatever.
I don't know how they did it, but I do know that the bound volume that came out from the Paris conference had
yeah.
questions and answers.
Right. Right.
And identified the questioner, and so it was, I'm not sure how it was done.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it's a nice thing
yes.
to have. You see what people were thinking who were, you know, listening to those papers.
I think I have the Paris one here.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I've got a couple in the collection of mass spec books at home. I think I've got the first four conferences all together,
mm-hmm.
For sure. Did you meet anyone interesting at that conference, do you recall, at Oxford?
I can't recall meeting anything that changed my life.
But it was first international conference in Paris. Was the first time that you gave a paper at
yes.
the international conference. And that paper was on?
Ion molecular reactions.
Okay, more ion molecular
reactions. We were doing the zero field pulsing technique to get thermal energy. And we had done some work on defragmentation of organic molecules, organic ions as a function of time.
Oh, okay.
By pulsing and changing the time span.
Ah, okay.
And so it was a combination of those two.
Okay. So you would get information about energy dissipation as a function of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, okay, interesting.
It was an interesting conference.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And this time you had graduate students working for you in all this ion molecule reaction
yes.
stuff.
Yes.
And they were following through on the same kind of studies and basically were guiding them through their research work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, the 70s. How at this point you had actually probably gotten some responsibilities? You were saying you were an assistant chair.
I was associate chair of the department from 71 to 74.
So what does that entail?
I was running the undergraduate program.
Ah, okay. And how big was that program? I mean,
we had some very big courses because of the students who wanted hoping to get into medicine.
Yeah.
So the second year organic course, first year general chemistry course were very large.
Uh-huh.
You had several sections of lectures.
Mm.
So I had to juggle people around and make sure that
yeah.
people got reasonable lecture loads.
Yeah, yeah. These big sections are a bit of a challenge. I assume that they had help with grading papers and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Because... you know, it's a lot of work to grade a couple hundred papers.
When it gets to be 500, it's even more.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I remember we had take over a lab for a while in the summer after the exams were written and all the lecturers would be sitting there going through all these damn papers.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what's done now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a challenge, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But as part of the educational process. And so that was the primary, as your associate chair, that was the primary challenge.
My primary responsibility was the undergraduate program.
And you had to make sure that everybody got a fair share of the teaching.
Yes.
And nobody got over,
yes.
over been out of
shape. And deal with any ideas about changing the curriculum.
Okay.
This is also the time that... student activism was becoming significant,
oh, yeah.
so one had to deal with the student population as well.
So what were they being active about then?
Oh, they wanted to have a say in what was being taught and what was going on.
I see.
Which was a dicey situation.
Yeah. Yeah, so how did you handle those issues?
Probably poorly.
Yeah, well, that's got to be a little bit of a challenge for sure.
Mm-hmm.
when I know in some situations today, I talked to Keith Jennings in the UK a couple of years ago, and their chemistry is kind of, the chemistry department is kind of falling on hard times. They it's kind of like they have to have enough students to maintain the faculty, and not enough people are doing chemistry anymore over there. So, are you having any of those problems here?
No, I think things are going quite well in chemistry here. There has been a shift in emphasis in the department, and there's much more biological chemistry now.
Well, yeah.
And that attracts people, and much the other area, which is very popular, is environmental chemistry.
So it's still popular here.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. We have 1, 2, 4, or 5 faculty who are basically environmental chemists, and there seem to be, I go to some of the environmental chemistry seminars, and they're certainly very well attended in terms of numbers.
That's good.
So I think it's going fairly well, I think. Of course,
okay.
I'm out of the loop now.
Sure. Yeah, but it is kind of, I find it a bit disconcerting that, in the UK there should be a de-emphasis of this important scientific field because you don't have enough students, you know, to support the faculty. That's a little scary.
Well, how many students in Great Britain can now afford to attend university?
Well, then I guess that represents another.
The tuition fees have become rather enormous.
Okay, I wasn't aware of what that situation is.
I think they're up to £8,000 or so.
Oh my, okay. Well,
so only the affluent really can attend, so I think that's part of the reason why enrollment in universities in the UK is going down, and they're relying more and more on bringing people in from overseas.
Okay. That's happening everywhere, though.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I got the impression there may be a large Indian population in this area, in Toronto. Is that...
The large population of almost
any
type you want to talk about.
Oh, okay.
We have a very large Chinese population, a large Indian, Pakistan population, not so much in the downtown area, but if you go up to a fairly small town or a fairly large town up a bit north of Toronto called Brampton, you find that it's almost entirely Indian.
These people are, that brings up though the point about the cost of education. So for the University of Toronto, how pricey is University of Toronto these days?
I think it's around 6,000.
Canadian?
Canadian funds, Canadian dollars per year.
Okay, and is that just for tuition or?
Yes.
That's just for tuition.
Oh yes.
Okay, so an American, that would probably be about 7,000 maybe. American, I think. Wash U, where I was at, I think they're in the 20 to 25 or 30,000 range. So it's just getting extremely exorbitant in some of these private schools in the States these days.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently they're able to get people to attend them. Okay, well...
I'm just going to say, would you like to take a break and maybe get a coffee?
Sure, I think that would be a good idea. Why don't I push a button here?
If you can find the button.
Let's see, I think that button says that... the one I wanted to push, just push this one here. It says that we're recording now.
Okay.
So we're really continuing the earlier file of audio there. So we'd gotten into the mid-70s with your career, and now where do you want to go from there?
Well, I should note that in 75, the first 6 months I had a sabbatical leave, which I spent with Keith Jennings at Warwick. So I did have that time to collaborate with him. We had done some collaboration before that. But the whole area, it was fairly quiet. One of the problems that came up in the 70s, at least at Toronto, was the lack of graduate students in physical chemistry. People weren't interested, and those that were wanted to work with lasers.
Wow.
And I didn't have lasers. So I had problems with the supply of graduate students in the 70s, but fortunately I was able to get some postdocs and visiting scientists and so forth, keep things going.
How about funding? Was the funding, you were still getting funded?
I'm getting funded reasonably well, yes.
So it wasn't the problem that many people are experiencing today who are just starting out, and funding was pretty...
No, of course, by that time I was a full professor and had a fairly reasonable publication list.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing much of interest happened. I spent the first 6 months of 1982 at École Polytechnique Fédérale in Lausanne, working with the one Tina Goyman, G-A-U-M-A-N-N.
Okay.
Who had good instrumentations and so forth, and some of his colleagues.
What was the motivation of going there? Was that a sabbatical?
Tino had been... twisting my arm for some time to come and spend time with him.
Okay, you knew him through...
I knew him, I'd met him at various times.
Campuses. Okay. And so he said, why don't you come visit?
He was the director of the Institut de Chimie Physique.
Okay.
And had lots of money. They paid me fairly handsomely to be a visiting professor. Professor invité.
Invited, yes. So that was probably a fun thing.
Yes.
This was in...
But, of course, I mentioned earlier that Paul Cabarly had taught us how to ski.
Uh-huh.
So, for 6 months in Switzerland, why not ski?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So, where did you go skiing there?
There were several places near... We were near Lausanne, down in the valley, and you'd just go up any mountain pretty well, and you'd find a ski resort.
Uh-huh.
Then in 84, we got a group of us in Ontario here, got together to work out. We knew we weren't each going to get a mass spectrometer, a big one.
Uh-huh.
So we needed to set up regional centers.
Mm-hmm.
And so the one was a regional center for analytical mass spectrometry, which would be located at McMaster.
Mm-hmm.
The other was a regional center for gas phase ion chemistry,
mm-hmm.
which would be located at here at U of T.
Mm-hmm.
And my co-applicants were Bob Boyd and Ray March,
Oh, okay.
Who you may know.
Sure. Yes, definitely.
With support from others such as McMahon, Bohm, Stone, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was in Ontario?
Yes.
Provincial?
But the funding came from, by this time, NSERC was established, the Natural Science and Engineering Research Council.
And
so the money came from them.
Natural
Science and Engineering Research Council,
NSERC.
Which we call NSERC.
Okay. but you had to kind of decided to form a cooperative program amongst the
yes.
the people and the scientific community who would
yes.
use the mass spectrometry
because
in Ontario.
At that time, Boyd was at the University of Guelph, which wasn't too far away.
Mm-hmm.
March was at Trent University, again, which wasn't too far away.
Mm-hmm.
So we were the three main, going to be the three main users of the instrument.
Mm-hmm. For the gas phase ion chemistry studies.
Yes. And
this
we got funded in 1984 and ended up buying a ZAB2FQ from VG Analytical.
ZAB2F, that sounds vaguely familiar. Q, so they had a quadrupole at the end.
It was a BEQQ instrument.
B0BEQQ. Alphabet soup.
And so we got that money in 64, and the ASMS was somewhere on the West Coast at that time. Uh-huh. And we had a lot of chats with Chris Porter at VG Analytical about what we could do. Mm-hmm. In fact, Chris was very helpful. He was the VG man we dealt with. So that machine was delivered in 85.
Okay.
In the summer of 85. Here's a picture of the gang at the VG mm-hmm. plant in England mm-hmm. on the okay. final tests of the instrument.
Yeah. So with this instrument, you have to have a retardation of the ions before you get into your cue, right?
That's right, yes.
Was that a significant problem?
No, it seemed to work very well.
Okay.
This was the first one that had been produced commercially.
Okay.
Of that configuration. That's Chris Porter, by the way, from
okay.
VG. I guess it was Graham Cooks that probably built one uh-huh. Himself, but this was the first commercial one.
And why did you... Well, let's see, I guess the first two sectors gave you high resolving power.
Yes.
So you could be a bit more selective in your ion.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
Well, one could do in the... you could mass select with the magnet mm-hmm. and look at CID, high-energy CID, with analyzing by the kinetic energy with the electrostatic analyzer.
Okay.
You could also get into this game, which we got into a bit, of neutralization, reionization of ions, mm-hmm. Which McLafferty and Chris Wisdemiotis and other had started.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could take your ions through, as you say, with double focusing resolution and decelerate them into the quadrupole cell and do CID as a function of, say, collision energy and so forth.
Uh-huh.
So it was a very versatile instrument.
And I think probably the my sense is that the QQ part was probably the technology for doing those experiments was pretty well developed mm-hmm. By that time. So that
yes.
made a lot of sense.
Yeah, there was the triple quads were around by then.
Yeah.
We thought of a triple quad, but decided this was much more versatile
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and managed to persuade the site visiting committee to...
Once again?
Well, they didn't actually want to fund the quadrupole part.
Oh, really?
But we worked out a deal with VG that the BE part was actually used.
Mm-hmm.
It had been used for a year or so, I think, in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a reduced price on that so we
oh.
could have enough money to tack the QQ onto the end.
So you got to use BE in a new QQ.
Right.
Well, it's. I mean, they're always willing to work with people.
Yeah, they were very helpful.
So I'm the funding committee was not interested in supporting the addition of the QQ.
Yeah, they didn't think that was really necessary.
I thought it was like icing on the cake or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, if you're going to do ion molecule work, it seems to me it would be highly necessary.
We did more work in the Q part of the instrument
yeah.
than anywhere else.
Yeah, I would think so.
That instrument worked, I guess, until about 1998.
Okay.
At which time I had no students, and we had enough instruments in the service laboratory. I could do my research there, so
mm-hmm.
we got rid of it.
Mm-hmm. What happens to these old instruments like that? Do they just get converted into scrap metal?
I think a lot of this one went to somebody whose name I can't. It was a chap who worked with John Holmes in Ottawa.
Oh, okay.
Who rescued old mass spectrometers. And I think a lot of it went to a chap at Rancelet.
Okay.
But I'm not quite sure about that.
Okay.
I can't remember his name.
Okay.
But it was removed from without charge for us.
Uh-huh.
So they could play around with it.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, well, I mean, it probably still worked, I would imagine.
Yep.
It's just no more use of it for a year, so he had to find some other place for it.
I might also mention that in 85, I was awarded a Killam Fellowship.
A what?
A Killam. K-I-L-L-A-M.
Okay.
This is a Canadian award. Isaac Walton Killam was in the financial business in the year, first half of the 20th century.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't have any family, so when he died first, when his wife died, she set up the Killam Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And the Killam Fellowship gives you, or gives the university, enough money to hire a replacement for lecturing for the staff member who gets the award.
Okay.
And the staff member is supposed to be excused from all teaching and administrative duties.
Okay.
So I had 2 years of that, which coincided with the arrival of this instrument.
Oh, wow, okay.
So it worked very well.
Yeah.
Of course, my application emphasized what all the things we could do with this instrument.
Yeah, yeah.
So it that worked out very nicely.
So you never had a situation that John Bynum had where when he got his Royal Society Fellowship, they gave the money to him.
Uh-huh.
They didn't give it to the school.
Oh.
Which caused the school a great deal of consternation.
Uh-huh.
But basically, they put it in they put it in a bank account that only he could draw from.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the bank was happy to have it because they were, you know, could, you know, earn use it to earn interest. But it was kind of interesting that he it was his money. It was,
No, that's not the way the Killam works.
It's,
it gives the money to the university, and I think it's now about $70,000 a year.
Okay.
So that you have $70,000. The university has $70,000 to hire a replacement lecturer.
They're directed to what they can do with it, but it's their money. It isn't, you know, it's
they're free to do, I think, whatever they want with the money, but
the understanding is.
But the understanding that I'm to be that the recipient is to be relieved of teaching and administrative duties.
Now, did you apply for this?
Yes.
Okay, so it's something that you knew was available.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Some of my colleagues had had them.
Ah, so you knew that was a good thing. This is a 2-year program.
Yes.
And it gave you enough money to do what you wanted.
Well, it didn't give me any money directly. It gave me the free time.
The free time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. To pursue some science. And so you were actually you didn't have to bother with teaching then.
Pardon?
You didn't have to bother with teaching.
Not for 2 years, yes. Yes.
Really get in there and do some work.
Yes.
And hopefully, I guess you didn't have any administrative.
No, I didn't have any administrative duties for those 2 years either. I was relieved of those.
So that was an opportunity to make some headway, serious headway in molecule reaction studies.
And we got into negative ions, which we hadn't been able to do before.
Okay. Now,
negative ion chemistry.
Worked, why? What was the hindrance to doing negative ion?
You get different reactions, negative ion molecular reactions. Different things happening.
So you're starting out with negative ions coming out of the ion source?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, you're doing chemical ionization in the negative mode.
Okay.
In the ion source.
Okay. Now, it's not really feasible to do any much in the way of negative ion work with an EI source, is it? Did you do any, or is there?
Well, we did some, yes.
Okay.
We did a whole pile of stuff, but.
And negative ions in EI mode?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So we could take the negative ions into the quadrupole and do CID. And
okay. This was in the 80s?
Yes, this was in the last half of the 80s.
Okay. But prior to that, you weren't doing
except for the time I spent with Keith Jennings,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
where we did do some negative ion work.
And so the whole field of negative ion is probably
hadn't had a lot of activity,
underexplored.
So it was nice to explore.
Yeah. And you say the reactions that occur, the ion molecule reactions occur in negative ion mode are completely different than what you would observe in the positive ion.
Yeah.
It's
an alternative way of negative ion chemical ionization is an alternative to the normal positive proton transfer.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Don Hunt in Virginia started a lot of the negative iron work.
Uh-huh. But this is still not very much done with negative irons.
No.
I guess they're just a little bit...
It hasn't really caught on.
Yeah.
Many instruments are not capable of detecting negative ions very efficiently.
Yes. It's an interesting problem. There's still ions, but it's mm-hmm. just like it's they somehow they behave differently.
Yes.
I mean, even though they're you can use the same optics and whatnot to move them around and do that kind of stuff. Well, that was a good experience, Cindy. I guess you were able to get some extra publications out during that period when you didn't have any other responsibilities.
Mm.
Okay, so what other areas? This is the mid-80s?
Yes, this is the last half of the 80s that,
okay.
That we got the ZAB instrument.
Mm-hmm.
It proved so popular that... the National Research Council Atlantic Laboratories in Halifax, mm-hmm. Nova Scotia, bought one, and they enticed Bob Boyd to move from the University of Guelph to the National Research Council in Halifax to use their ZAB-Q.
so
we lost Boyd.
Okay, but in the meantime, the instrument got him another job, different job, and. It proved its worth.
Yes.
The addition of the Q was...
It became quite a popular instrument. I guess our first publication describing the instrument was well received.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've seen it's one among your more heavily cited papers, at least from the citations that I can find out about.
Mm-hmm.
So that really was an instrument that was a commercial instrument. It was not something that you guys built here.
Oh no,
okay.
No, no.
Very good.
We called the center the Ontario Regional Ion Chemistry Laboratory. Regional Ion Chemistry Laboratory,
uh-huh.
or Oracle for short.
Very nice. Yes. Yeah.
And we had money for some time to have a full-time manager
mm-hmm.
who kept the thing going and scheduled people on and so forth.
So you actually would set it up so other people could use it.
Oh yes.
From around the
anybody who wanted to could come in and do their experiments with the help of the manager.
Did you have some kind of a vetting process or submission of a proposal or to use it?
No, if Ray March decided that one of his students should come down and do some experiments, that was fine.
Okay.
We booked them in as much as we could.
Uh-huh.
I think it worked out fairly smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out that Ray was the one who did the most
mm-hmm.
Work on it from outside. Because,
mm-hmm.
as I say, Bob Boyd moved to Halifax.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a bit of a loss for you guys.
Well, he had a good career there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. No, he's not there anymore, is he?
He's retired.
Yeah, sure, okay.
And I moved to Vancouver.
Uh-huh, yes. Okay, what next then? In, if you kind of explore this negative ion chemistry world?
Well, we were able to finally do some... by putting reagent gases in the quadrupole collision cell, we're able to do some work on identifying ion structures by ion molecule reactions. This was something we'd been trying to do. It was my original idea back in the 50s and 60s, but it wasn't until the 80s when we could, say, put methylamine in the collision cell and bombarded with different ions to see what the reactions were, and there was other people doing some of the same sort of work. John Tedder, for example, in the UK.
So this, you might call this
reactive collisions.
Reactive collisions,
and
yeah.
Collision, reactive yeah. collisions, yes.
As opposed to ion molecule collisions.
Right, yes.
You're actually promoting some kind of chemistry going on.
And it was, really that was quite a bit of work done in the 80s and late 80s.
So the reactions that you got, the mass spec data from that would give you some clues to the structure of the ion?
Yeah, and we did put deuterated methanol in.
Okay.
CH3OD.
Mm-hmm.
Put in ions then and looked for the exchange. How many exchanges occurred and so forth.
Okay.
And so that was another, it opened up a whole
yeah.
general area. There were there were some other people doing this sort of thing. John Tedder in St. Andrews in Scotland
mm-hmm.
was doing some of this work.
T-E-D-D-E-R.
It was Lord Tedder, actually. His father was one of the big wheels in England during the Second World War.
Oh, okay.
And he had a student from Finland, Jorma Jalonen, who did a lot of that work, too.
How do you spell that?
J-O-R-M-A, J-A-L-O-N-E-N.
Okay.
He had worked with Tedder.
And this was in the reaction molecule.
This was in the reactive collisions.
Reactive
yes.
Collision. Okay. So that's how much? This is pretty kind of a small field, right?
Yes. Yes.
So you guys were doing it, and the people here.
Yes, there are a few other people who were incidentally doing it.
Yeah.
I was asked to give a keynote lecture when the International Mass Spectrometry Conference was held in Finland, because
mm-hmm.
they were interested in this sort of thing. So. I gave a keynote lecture on reactive collisions.
Mm-hmm. And this you primarily was why you got this kind of an instrument?
There were many reasons, because it was a very versatile instrument, which mm-hmm. allowed you to do all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I wanted to do when we got on into the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, was to start looking at peptides.
Okay.
But we didn't have a fab source. It looked like it was going to be fast atom bombardment on this instrument, was what we needed if we were going to get into biological molecules.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I wanted to get into that was that back in the 70s, one of my students, Chun Tsang, Chun Tsang, had done quite a bit in chemical ionization of carboxylic acids. And he came to me and said, well, I'd like to do amino acids. And I said, well, why? We know that carboxylic acids lose, when they're protonated, lose water and form the acylium ion. And so what's going to be happen with amino acids? Well, it turned out he was right and I was wrong. They don't form amino acylium ions, which are unstable with respect to kicking off CO and forming the ammonium ion. So I knew that what they were called in the peptide world in the 80s, B ions, that B1 ions weren't stable, but B2 and larger ions were stable. I didn't see why putting an amino acid residue on the end of a should make them suddenly stable unless something was happening. So this was something I wanted to try.
By this time, your graduate student was long gone, though.
Oh, yes. He was having a good career at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University.
But he had a good idea.
He had a good idea. We published a paper. We published some back-of-the-envelope calculations that, in fact, this was an exothermic reaction for the acylium ion to lose CO.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been better calculations since. So I applied to NSERC for a number of years to get a fab source and fast atom gun, and didn't have success.
Now, that would not have been a very expensive proposition.
I didn't think so. but they didn't want to give it to me. Mm-hmm. Finally, I convinced VG, or I think by that time it was Fisons, mm-hmm. That they could support my research. So they gave me a long-term loan of a fast atom source, mm-hmm. atom gun, and a source. Mm-hmm. We already had on an instrument in this lab the power supplies to run the gun.
Yeah.
So we got into fab on this instrument, which again was very useful.
And when would that have been?
That was 93.
Oh, okay. So
that they gave me the loan.
Because fab was had been used pretty heavily by
the
80s, right?
Or yes.
When it came out. So.
Yes.
So but we were kind of behind the curve.
We had it for the analytical service.
Ah, okay.
but we didn't have it in on the ZAB, which was where I wanted it.
Yeah.
And so we got that. That was the year I retired, actually, mm-hmm. 1993.
Okay.
I took early retirement.
Was that for cause or because you wanted to? Or
The university was in very difficult financial condition. They were trying to get the high-priced help off the payroll.
Uh-huh.
So they made it attractive to take early retirement.
I see. It'll sweeten the kitty.
And I knew my pension wasn't going to be that great.
Yeah.
So in effect, they basically paid me $150,000 to
avoid
$350,000 of salary.
Uh-huh.
And so I retired, but I confirmed that I could carry on.
So this was, you would be 62 then. So
yes.
Yes,
I was going to have to retire at 65.
I mean, that was the law.
Pardon? That was the law at that time. Okay. So I knew I was. I'd only had three more years before I had to retire, so why not get some money out of it?
Yeah. And then, particularly now you have the understanding that you could continue to work.
Oh, yes.
So
yes.
That meant you gave you what? An office?
I had my office. I still had my lab.
Over
the years, of course, the lab has disappeared. My office has been downsized to here.
Mm-hmm.
But I still have an office.
Mm-hmm.
I still can use the machines that are in the service laboratory, which we can visit sometime.
Okay.
That's when we got into peptide mass spectrometry.
So
I thought it would take a couple of years to sort out these problems that, uh-huh. about B ions, but it got me so involved. I'm still carrying on.
So B ions were not as simple as they thought.
No, not at all.
Not at all. And so that's another area where I think you've been getting a fair amount of press, so to speak. In the
yes.
Why are B ions stable species in peptide spectra? I got 241 sites for that paper.
Yeah, that would be.
That was published in 95 after you retired.
Yes. we got the fast atom fab essentially going in the summer of 93.
Mm-hmm.
And I put a fourth year student research project to look at that problem.
Mm-hmm.
She got enough results that it looked as though we had something.
Mm-hmm.
And in the summer of spring of 94, I had a postdoc come in by the name of Talat Yalcin. Talat Yalcin from Turkey.
Okay.
And he tackled the problem with great enthusiasm.
Uh-huh.
And
we
showed that the B2 ion was a cyclic oxazolone, as they call it.
Cyclic.
Essentially, as the bond was breaking and the amide bond breaking, the next carbonyl group came over and cyclized.
Okay.
And that did a lot.
So the original fourth year student was investigating these B ions and using fab to produce
looking at the fragmentation.
Peptides, small peptides.
Yes, and particularly looking at the metastable ion loss of fragmentation when they lost carbon monoxide, the B2 ions.
Uh-huh.
And this occurred with considerable kinetic energy release, so we began to have some idea of the potential energy surface.
Ah, okay.
And Talat carried this on, and we got involved with one of my colleagues who's a theoretician and did theory on it, mm-hmm. and it all worked out very well.
Okay. So that's part of that the paper about the ions that came out in...
95.
90.
We published, that was our first paper in the in that field.
Yeah, and of course by this time the whole business of proteins and peptides is starting to take off.
Oh yes.
Because now ways of seeing these things, ionizing these biological
are becoming
involved. Yes, well, you know, that's as I say, the dirty little secret about mass spectrometry. If you can't make an ion out of it, then, you know.
Now, these days, yes.
But nowadays, I think you can make an ion out of about everything.
Yes.
That I can think of. So, that's your first foray into the peptide work. A lot of people are interested. Why? I mean, it's kind of very fundamental. But apparently, people see that as an important...
It's a field that has the fundamental studies, one hopes, the more you understand about how a protonated peptide fragments, the more it will help in sequencing.
Ah, okay.
That's the basic, the fundamental idea is that this is going to help mm-hmm. if you know such and such a, which bond breaks, why, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that we have solved all the problems of peptide sequencing.
Well, but I mean, you've got put in some effort to it over the last 20 years.
Yes.
And so that's work that's appreciated, I think, by people who are doing it as using it as a regular tool. I'm just kind of curious. Let me do a little sort here on my papers. Let me just. Sort them by so since then I looking at there's this paper on gas phase basicities and proton affinities of amino acids and peptides that's gotten a lot of attention.
Yes.
And why is that so important?
People seem to be interested in wanting to know what was the proton affinities of amino acids and small peptides.
Uh-huh.
It turns out that there was a critical analysis of the data that was available.
Uh-huh.
And it seems that I did fairly well in establishing the proton affinities.
Okay. These are measured?
These were measured, calculated, mostly measured. I used mostly experimental work.
Uh-huh.
Very quite recently, one Guy Bouchou from in France mm-hmm. Published another review of amino acids,
mm-hmm.
Basicities and proton affinities, mm-hmm. based mostly on calculations.
Mm-hmm.
He's primarily a theoretician.
Okay.
And his numbers came out in the most part to be in good agreement with what I had recommended in 97. Was it 97 or 99?
This
99, I think.
That's
97. 97, okay.
Proton affinities and peptides. And how do you spell this fellow's name in France, the theoretician?
Bouchou?
Yeah.
Bouchoux.
Bouchoux, okay. So he's trying to get at it from a first principles calculation.
He does experimental work, but he's very good at the calculations.
Okay.
There was some possibility that I might collaborate with him on this newer summary, but I told him to go ahead and do it on his own.
Oh, okay. This is a recent publication you're doing.
Yes, it's in 2012 in Mass Spec Reviews.
Okay. So this work has gotten a lot of attention. Amide bond dissociation in protonated peptides, structures of N-terminal ionic and neutral fragments. And that was also published in 97 with over 100 sites. That seems to be this really fundamental work, and
yes.
is very attractive. You got scrambling of sequence information and collision-induced associated with peptides. It's also...
That creates problems. We had pretty well established that B-ions were oxazolones. Mm-hmm. That is, you had this five-membered ring at the C-terminal, mm-hmm. and then the chain terminating in an amine at the N-terminal. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, fine. Why don't I go ahead and use MS-MS-MS techniques mm-hmm. to do collision-induced dissociation of the B-ions to get sequence information.
Mm-hmm.
And I found, when I'd looked at some B5 ions, that I got the same spectrum as if I'd taken the cyclic peptide with the same residues,
mm-hmm.
protonated it, and dissociated it.
Hmm.
In other words, I got ions which weren't indicative of the sequence.
Mm-hmm.
By this time, I had worked established a collaboration with one Della Pais,
mm-hmm.
P-A-I-Z-S, who at that time was at the German Cancer Research Center in somewhere in Germany.
Germany.
Yeah, I forget.
Münster, Berlin, Munich.
No, it was. I know it. It'll come back to me in a minute. I had established, he was a theoretician. And by this time, Csizmadia, who I had worked with here, had disappeared, mm-hmm. gone back to Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
So Bella did the calculations and all this, and we published a note in mm-hmm. 2006 in the full paper in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out what's happening is this. When you get to B5, you have the oxalone here and the amine here. The amine comes up around and attacks the oxazolone,
mm-hmm.
and you get a cyclic form, which then you can reopen at different bonds and fragment, and so you get sequence scrambling.
So you shouldn't have bothered looking.
That idea doesn't work,
yeah.
like many of my ideas,
mm-hmm.
But it does create some problems.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's still controversy over how significant this is in terms of peptide sequencing.
Yeah.
There are different views.
Yeah, well, it's, they don't need to make things more complicated.
Yes.
They're bad, complicated enough as it is. So that's been pretty much your total focus since...
since about 93.
Yeah, since you really got into the peptides. And this is a fertile area as well, so because it draws a lot of attention. Let me see. So let's see. You have no really serious issues with trying to develop any financial support for your research project. That's been something that's been...
Well, once I retired, NSERC started decreasing my grant.
Oh, okay.
And I decided in 2010
uh-huh.
that I wouldn't bother to apply for further renewal.
Okay.
That would have been for 2011.
Okay.
So I didn't apply for renewal. So my grant should have ended in the spring of 2011.
Uh-huh.
But they gave me a year to use up what I still had left.
Okay. So this...
so it's now, 2013 is really the time that I don't have funds.
Now the...
It's inevitable I'm going to retire sometime before too long. I've got to. Well, they'll put me 12 feet under or 6 feet under.
Yeah, the insert granting situation, is that a year renewable thing or a two-year renewable? Or once you get in the chain?
Sometimes it's two, sometimes it's three. I just forget what my last ones were.
It's kind of once you get in the system, you're there if you don't screw up. Is that kind of the way it works?
I had, at the time I retired in 93, I was getting about $55,000 a year
mm-hmm.
in grant.
Mm-hmm.
By what?
You're not getting any salary from the university once you retire?
No.
Right, okay.
So
this is your...
This is my money for research.
Okay, research.
It's not
fund.
Going into my pocket.
Mm-hmm.
By 2001 to 2005, they had me down to 20.
Mm-hmm.
That was a five-year grant.
Okay.
$20,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And again, from 2005 to 2011, essentially $20,000 a year. It was my first step towards really retiring.
Mm-hmm. So when did you stop taking graduate students, or did you have you stopped, or what?
Yes.
Okay.
Once I retired, I was made a professor emeritus.
Mm-hmm.
It was possible for me to supervise MSc students,
mm-hmm.
but I couldn't supervise PhD students.
Okay.
I decided I wouldn't do either.
Okay.
So for a few years after I retired, I had fourth-year students working with me.
Oh, okay.
In their research projects.
Is that pretty much standard to have a fourth-year student do a research project?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, it's an optional.
Okay.
They don't have to, but many of them do.
All right.
And I kept postdocs until about 98 or 99.
Okay. So it's you're really kind of shutting things down, but I mean, you're still getting stuff in literature, publications, 2013.
A little bit.
You know,
a little bit.
Yeah. So, well, you know, it's obviously work that people are interested in, so why not?
Why not? Yeah, it's fun. What I really like is getting into the lab and doing experiments.
Uh-huh.
That I find that very satisfying.
Well, that's good. It's good you have the opportunity to do it, but I mean, like you say, you probably are not going to be doing much too much more longer. But
not a lot, no.
Have you ever had any issues other than with the department or with the university, other than the fact that they wanted to kind of save money by getting into a retirement situation? But I mean, you've had pretty good support from the university throughout your career here in terms of...
I have no complaints.
No complaints, good.
In fact, the money for the DuPont 21-490 came from the university.
Oh, okay. Now, is that the
one? Chemical ionization instrument.
Okay, so that would be the research instrument.
Yes.
The NRC paid for the service instrument.
The Dyno 2.
Yeah.
The MS-902.
Oh, no, I'm sorry about 21-490.
There was a 21-490.
There were two of them, right?
Yes, one was in my research group, and that was funded by the university. And the one that was in the service lab was also funded by the university,
okay. So
as I recall.
They picked up both of them.
Yeah, seemed to be some money around at that time.
Yeah. What did you think of that instrument?
We did some changes to it, mm-hmm. increased the differential pumping.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked quite well.
Okay, because it was essentially that was derivative of. I mean, DuPont ended up inheriting CEC through a fairly complicated route, and so it was kind of like the swan song, I think, for the CEC.
It was turned out to be the swan song for DuPont too,
yeah.
In terms of mass spec.
Yeah. By speaking of which, did you ever have any CEC instruments from Consolidated Engineering Corporation or Consolidating Electrodynamics?
No.
In your experience?
No.
Because they obviously had a very large impact in the field in the beginning.
Oh, yes. I mean, it was a choice when we wanted to get into double focusing, whether we went with the CEC instrument or the AEI instrument.
Uh-huh.
We went to the AEI.
So I guess at that time the CEC instrument was photoplate detection.
Yes.
And did that affect it?
That was one of the considerations that it would look better to maybe go the other way.
Because that was a seriously contentious issue at the time.
Yes.
Detection,
which way to go?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
People spent a lot of time arguing about that.
Right.
Computers kind of made that trivial, since you can process data right up to electro detection is detecting it. So,
mm-hmm. Well, that's been one of the main advances in the last 50, 60 years, our computers.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Did you ever get any negative feedback in your when you go to publish your work, did the, you have any, what you might say, hostile reviews or reviewers that kind of more or less said this isn't really worth publishing? Or
oh, yes, there have been a few withdrawn.
Is this, how did these things get resolved? Did you go to the editor?
I think if the criticism got too much, I withdrew the paper.
Ah.
I didn't need publications. It wasn't uh-huh. essential.
Okay. But do you think the criticism was fair, or was it just...
Well, one of the amusing ones was the first paper we published after I came to U of T.
Mm-hmm.
We submitted it to a journal. It was a question of terbium versus benzyl ion structures.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd done some appearance potentials, which we correlate for beta and para isomers
mm-hmm.
of the what we produced were presumably benzyl ions. And we had, with Cabarly and Lossing, I'd published a paper on the ionization energies of the benzyl ions, mm-hmm. substituted benzyl ions. So we knew how what the difference was in the ionization energy, and the bond energies were all pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
So did the when you did produce the ion, substituted C787 ion by electron impact, did the appearance energies reflect the difference in the ionization energies,
mm-hmm.
in which case you presumably had a benzyl structure, or did they be the same, in which case you probably had a terpillium structure?
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out in many cases we had the terpillium structure,
mm-hmm.
in a couple of cases we had a benzyl structure. I submitted that paper, I think it was published in 62,
mm-hmm.
and the one of the criticisms was, if you believe this work, it's interesting, but...
It's a nice way to start the review.
Yes.
What do you think I'm doing here? and obviously you've had good work funding, so you haven't really had any serious rejections in the funding department, I would assume.
No, the only problem I had was getting this fab source.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only time I had any troubles.
Yeah, and it seems like it's kind of interesting. It's not, I wouldn't like be so as an expensive request, I wouldn't think.
No, it wasn't terribly expensive, but they just...
Maybe they didn't like the idea of fab.
They didn't, well, I guess not, or they didn't think I should be doing it.
interesting. Throughout all of this, have you done any patent? Work where any work would be patentable?
No.
Considered patentable or so. Because I think there's a push in American universities since, I don't know, the 90s to try and patent anything that comes out of the...
You'd better believe it.
Yeah.
Especially, there is certainly in Canada.
There is?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
The grants for basic fundamental research are not increasing, but the any funding that is increasing is going for things which hopefully will produce something useful within the next few years.
Something patentable.
Yes, and makeable and make money for the economy.
Well, so, I mean, the theory is that research is a source of creating wealth eventually. But I don't know if it'd be so A-B connected.
That is something I have some problems with, that we can dictate what result we're going to get. And it's going to be useful, and it's going to sell millions and solve the country's economy. But that is certainly the attitude that is being taken these days.
Well, it's something
I think there's a lot of room... basic research, which may lead to something or may not, but at least it's advancing knowledge, not just using it.
Yeah. Okay, well, I had one point I was going to touch on, and it slipped through my mind while I was talking about some other stuff, so let me review some of the other items I've got in here. So you really haven't done any instrumentation development, but you've selected instrumentation that is well-suited for the type of research that you want
yes,
to do.
Yes,
yes. You've done some instrument modification, I would assume.
Yes, of course, the zero-field pulsing mm-hmm. was adapting and work of Tal Rosa, mm-hmm. which we used extensively. Then in about 68 or 69, that required setting up all sorts of pulse generators mm-hmm. and so forth and feeding that through. In 68 or 69, we started doing what we call trapped ions. The idea was you had a low energy electron beam to the energy low enough that didn't cause ionization. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while you pulse that up to ionize for a short time, and the positive ions got trapped in the negative electron space charge mm-hmm. of the electron beam.
The one that you had created?
The one we created with the pulse of high energy electrons.
Okay.
And then you could let them sit there and stew and eventually push them out with the repeller.
Mm-hmm.
And this was first brought to our attention when a chap by the name of Danby at Oxford mm. published a paper in this.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do any ion molecule reactions. He was C.J. Danby. I don't know what his first name was.
Mm-hmm.
D-A-N-B-Y. So I wrote to him and said, are you going to do ion molecule reactions? Because mm-hmm. If you are, I'll leave it to you.
Yeah.
If not, I'd like to do it. He mm-hmm. said, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a good postdoc at the time by the name of Alan Herod.
Mm-hmm.
H-E-R-O-D, and we set up this this trapped ions technique, and we found we could trap ions for up to for milliseconds.
Oh, wow.
So you could do all sorts of sequential ion molecule reactions. So we used that quite a bit for a while.
So you've got these ions that you form sitting inside the ion source for a period of time.
Yes.
And they're...
They're colliding with the neutral molecules.
Okay.
Giving... and there's a negative well, of course.
Okay.
From the electron beam, which right. was 8 or 10 microamps.
So that's kind of keeping those guys...
Keeping them there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it gives them...
They're oscillating back and forth.
Right. Yeah.
It turned out that they're... our best estimate was that their kinetic energy was about a third of an electron volt.
Oh, okay. And then you could see they were self-reacting, the ions and the neutrals.
Oh, yes.
They were
so, for example, if you took methane
uh-huh.
In a mixture, say, with something of a higher proton affinity, and mostly methane, a little bit of felt, you could see the methane ion molecule products come up and then go down as they ionize the next one.
Mm.
So you could follow these sequential reactions.
Mm.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that sounded like it'd be an interesting experiment. When was that done?
That was done in the late 60s. I think our first publication was 1970.
Okay.
Alan Herod, who did the work, spent most of his working career with the British Coal Board.
Oh, wow.
And became an expert on the chemistry of coal and coal derived products.
Mm-hmm. An important source of energy.
Mm-hmm.
With all kinds of problems associated with it.
Yeah.
Let me see here. I'm going to go through and check further. Are there any things that we haven't covered that you wanted to talk about while I'm looking up?
No, I think I've covered most of it.
I did have a question about your most significant publications. Didn't you mention that you were interested in the ones that were the most fun?
What?
Did you mention that you were most interested in the publications that were the most fun as opposed to the most significant?
I have no problems with the ones that are referred to.
Mm-hmm.
The one at the top of the list is a paper that I got involved in when I was on sabbatical at the University of Colorado.
Oh, yeah. What was that about?
That was the bond energies in ethylene and acetylene.
Ah, yes. Now, that's kind of a esoteric.
And I worked with Chuck DePue and Veronica Beerbohm for six months in 1989. And another staff member, whose name I forget now, came in one day and said, "This is an interesting problem, bond energy and something or other, and ethylene, I think it was. It'll only take you a couple of days to solve this." 6 months later, we had half the department, including Carl Leinberger, involved in this, and it was a very good paper. Got all the bond energies in ethylene and acetylene. By negative ion mass spectrometry and the photo detachment of electrons by Leinberger, got all the information we needed to get good values. It was a fun project.
So this guy waltzed into the lab and wanted this information.
Well, he thought it would be an interesting project that we could solve in a couple of days.
I see. But
it took 6 months.
And it took half the department.
Well, it was a couple of postdocs with DePue, some postdocs and students with Carl Leinberger, Carl himself. Oh, Barney Ellison was the chap's name who had this idea.
Uh-huh.
I think his name was on the paper, too.
Okay.
He looked like a former of lawyers, the list of authors.
That's interesting. Yeah, so, now, how is this information useful? You got all this high detailed information about acetylene and ethylene.
I get it. People are doing reactions of ethylene and acetylene. It's useful to have this type of bond energy information.
I wonder how many people are in that area.
Well, it's had over 350 citations.
Yeah, wow. Interesting. Yeah, bond strength, ethylene, acetylene, 1990.
Yes.
Yeah. Fun. So any other fun papers that you recall with fondness?
Oh, they were all, most of them were pretty good fun. There was one in 67, which has been popular, was popular at the time anyway, in which we were concerned with ion molecule reactions involving polar molecules.
Hmm.
What role did the dipole play of the polar molecule? And we worked out the theory for the case where the dipole locked in with the approaching ion in the most favorable way, and worked out what the rate of collision would be and the rate of reaction, and then showed experimentally that that didn't apply. But that, of course, created some interest.
Yeah.
And I think it basically led to Mike Bauer's theoretical calculations of average dipole orientation and things like that to explain the effect of dipoles on ion molecule reactions.
Neat.
I suppose the one thing that wasn't actually fun was writing the book on chemical ionization mass spectrometry.
Oh, yes. That's... That was apparently book writing is not so much excitement. Why? What prompted you to do that?
I thought it might be an interesting exercise, and CRC Press approached me.
Uh-huh.
Would I write this? Write a monograph on that? So I decided to try it, and then they wanted a second edition. So that was easier because I bet then I was computer. Able to use computers.
Yeah, the first time was pretty challenging, I would imagine, without the...
Yeah, I had wrote it out in handwriting and had a secretary here in the department type it up for me. But by the 90s, when we did the second one, it was computer-generated. My wife tells me if I ever do it again, it'll be divorce. In fact, I was approached to write a third edition of the book, and I said, "No way."
No.
I General chemical ionization isn't used a lot these days.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
What is used is atmospheric pressure.
Sure.
Chemical ionization.
So that, when did that start to be such a popular, that was kind of a Canadian development, wasn't it?
The SCIEX.
Uh-huh.
A company up on the north end of the city,
mm-hmm.
or just outside the city. Got into this area in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
The person who was responsible for it was a professor in the Institute for Aeronautics at U of T.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Barry French.
Barry?
Barry French, F-R-E, well, just ordinary French.
Mm-hmm.
He developed these methods. That was where SCIEX started.
Mm, okay. And that's been pretty much taken over the chemical ionization field these days.
Yes.
It's probably a little bit simpler, and it's become much more of an analytical tool than a research.
And can't think of his name. There was a chap in Vienna who did a lot of work, too. Proton transfer, mass spectrometry. I just can't think of his name at the moment.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I've met him a few times, and we corresponded quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But he accidentally died while in holiday in Hawaii.
That's not good. Okay, I don't know, do you have any other things for now? We could break for lunch, I guess.
Maybe we should go to lunch.
Yes, all right.
The faculty club is fairly close.